In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
I'd like you to think back to ancient history, the 1980s. At the time, we were battling the evil empire, the Soviet Union. It was so long ago that Alec Baldwin actually played the role of an American patriot, Jack Ryan, in The Hunt for Red October. It was a story about a Russian naval commander and his officers who have become disillusioned with the Soviet Union and steal the newest stealth submarine and attempt to defect to the U.S. while being pursued by the Soviets. There's a scene in that movie I'll always remember. Captain Ramius is talking with his lieutenant who dreams of moving to Montana and getting a pickup truck and drive from state to state. "Do they let you do that?" he asks. Ramius says, "I suppose." The lieutenant is stunned with the thought of such freedom and asks, "No papers?" "No papers," Ramius replies. "State to state." Here we are, nearly 30 years after that movie, and despite the ineffectiveness of government solutions, the vaccine, there is still talk of implementing a vaccine passport and a social credit score with which you may or may not be allowed privileges, like travel, state to state. If we become the Soviet Union, we didn't really beat them. They defeated us. There was another moment in more recent history that has bearing on today's show. In the early Obama years, Obama and his cronies were stinking up the economy. It was so bad that China sent a delegation to the White House to tell them they were doing capitalism all wrong. Do you remember that? It was laughable at the time. How bad was Obama that China had to tell them how to do capitalism? But now, looking back, maybe that wasn't what it appeared to be. Maybe what China was really doing was instructing them on how capitalism could be used as a weapon. We've certainly seen that ever since, as the massive corporations became even more massive and even more monopolistic, with no challenge to them from Congress. Using the excuse of COVID dragging on the economy, the Federal Reserve began buying corporate bonds. But they didn't go to mom-and-pop stores. They went to multinational companies who got bigger and bigger, while smaller companies got smaller, and many went away. Another point of history, Bill Clinton famously had a sign on his wall, "It's the economy, stupid." But what kind of economy will we have? We saw in Canada banks targeting individuals whose politics the government did not like. We see it now with Russia and Ukraine. Set aside the invasion part of things, we have private companies waging a private war on Russia. The CIA used to do that, undermine countries. Now private companies are doing it. Is this really the economy that we want? On today's show, we'll have a free-flowing discussion about the state of the economy, where it's headed, those in charge and private companies blocking you when they don't agree with your politics, and we'll look at true economic policies to win on in 2022, even right here in Oregon. To talk about all that, I'd like to welcome back Jonathan Williams. He's the Chief Economist and Executive Vice President for Policy at the American Legislative Exchange Council. Jonathan, it is great to talk to you.
Always great to join you, my friend. And as always, greetings I bring you from the land of make-believe here in Washington, D.C., that just is a little bit more make-believe after the president's remarks recently this week on the State of the Union.
Oh, yeah. Total fantasy from what I've heard. I did not actually listen to it. I'll just catch some of the roundup. But in the land of the make-believe, has Uber started offering unicorn rides yet?
Not quite.
It's coming, I'm sure. So in terms of Biden's speech there, do you get the sense now more than ever that the government is not your friend when it comes to economics? I mean, it's like they're playing by their own rules and expecting everyone else to follow, or they will, like Canada, trample you in the process, which is the opposite of intending government that should be there to set boundaries, not rules, terms, and conditions.
Yeah, right. I mean, this is a big issue. And, you know, this is something that I think unfortunately, the government, when you look at one of the biggest issues facing us all right now, is this really threat of inflation. That's not just a hypothetical threat. Mm-hmm. Of course, we are facing it. It's eroding our buying power. It's hurting every hardworking men and women across the United States right now, especially it penalizes savers, of course, people that have been trying to, you know, save up for that first-time home buyer situation or to put their kids through college. I mean, this is a big problem for all of us, and it gets to the heart of what you just talked about there, Mark, which is government actually does very well when it prints more money and it has big government policies and it causes inflation. Government's the beneficiary of that. And who hurts are the people. And unfortunately, the president's rhetoric this week in the speech when it comes to the State of the Union was, you know, talking about how you double down with more government programs and more government spending. In fact, I listened to the entire speech, and there were elements of it that were, you know, not as bad as others. But I mean, one of the things that really struck me was what it was missing, and that was any discussion whatsoever. Now that we have crossed this Rubicon economically of hitting $30 trillion of national debt, of enhancing spending in the hundreds of billions of dollars in every single package that we've talked about, if not trillion plus dollar packages, we are absolutely moving in the wrong direction when it comes to accruing debt, growing spending. And then, you know, we're surprised when inflation hits 40 or 50 year highs and it's hitting 7 or 8% and dramatically reducing standard of living across the board for hardworking Americans.
Well, it is crazy that the future, the long-term future like that is somehow completely missing from anything to do with policies. But that, I think, is the other crazy thing that's going on right now, is that what they say about their policies is completely devoid and separate from reality. They've got a situation where they've canceled the Keystone Pipeline, but they want to claim that somehow that didn't impact gas prices, that being a formerly energy independent country and all of this, you know, the inflation and everything with fuel, somehow those two aren't connected. And now we're actually importing oil from Russia at a time when we're trying to oppose them there in Ukraine. I mean, it's insane how there's just no connection between policies and reality. Do you think most people see that, though?
Yeah, well, you would hope. I mean, I think that, and it's not just Keystone, it's many, many other issues on the energy exploration space here in the United States that would make America more dependent or less dependent on foreign sources of oil and more energy independent here in terms of reliable, affordable energy sources that we can absolutely produce here domestically that would grow good paying American jobs. But the Biden administration and kind of the far left in Congress and in some states have every step of the way been harassing the oil and gas industry and putting this idea of this, you know, kind of the goals of green energy, of, you know, even the Jen Psaki, the president's press secretary the other day, you know, wouldn't even get pinned down on this topic to say, maybe we should open up Keystone XL and we should stop importing oil from Russia. It was all about how do we transition to green energy. And it's like, folks, we've got needs right now that that's great that we can do an all of the above energy approach, and we should, outside of government subsidies and, of course, outside of government involvement in terms of discriminatory taxes or big government policies. Every technology should be allowed to flourish in a free market, but it's fantasy land to think that you can immediately flip a switch and say we can just stop importing oil if we don't produce it ourselves. And the easy solution here, this is kind of policy 101, economics 101, is if when you have a price issue, supply and demand are at play. We're not going to dramatically reduce demand overnight in the United States. What we're going to need to do is increase domestic supply. That's the missing piece of it, and it was not talked about this week by the president, unfortunately.
No, and it's just a situation where you look at the actual outcomes of those policies. As you say there, we're now importing more from Russia than ever. So how do you trust the underlying policies there? And of course, you can't. We'll come back to this theme in another segment, but are we in danger of losing the free market system? Are we on the verge of it fading away? And if so, what will the new system look like?
Well, that's a big question there. I hope that we're not in danger of losing the free market system, because obviously that's been the thing that's made America, you know, what it is today in terms of the prosperity levels of not just the rich, but to allow everyone to succeed across all income levels and have that upward mobility that is the envy of many other nations across the country, across the globe, I should say, that, you know, this is the free market system that's allowed for that. And of course, what's the alternative? That's a very, very scary thought. The alternative is something of a command and control, big government, a centrally planned economy that has failed nearly everywhere it's been tried. I mean, just look at Venezuela. Look at the countries around the world that have transitioned from free market economies to big government, centrally controlled economies. And it doesn't work out very well, especially for working class, middle class individuals, those at the lower end of the income spectrum. It works out very well for the elite,
yes.
Works out very well for the rulers. It doesn't work out well for the people.
That's exactly right. And just watching that iron grip on economic policies and support of monopolies, it really does feel like we're verging away from the free market rather than embracing it, which is what we ought to do. All right. Everyone stay with us. We'll have more Jonathan Williams coming up. We'll be talking about the competency of those in charge. And welcome back. We're talking today to Jonathan Williams. He's co-author of Rich States, Poor States, an annual report by ALEC of competition among the states and a ranking of their economic outlook. Jonathan, when is that coming out this year?
Well, once again, just in time for tax day. And tax day, unless we hear otherwise, we'll be back on the dreaded April 15th this year, outside of the delays that we've seen in the last couple of years from the IRS that they've allowed us the extra time to file. So it'll just be right around the corner here, and it'll be the 15th edition of the report. So pretty exciting times ahead, and we'll see what kind of movement there is in the states this year. So many positive things moving in the states and great tax cuts and states looking to become more competitive. So we expect a very competitive top 10 list of states once again this year.
And if people want to find out more about that, you can go to either ALEC.org, that's ALEC.org, or you can go to richstatespoorstates.org, and we'll link those up on today's show page as well. And Jonathan, we've been talking a little bit about the Biden speech there and the Biden policymakers. And with the Trump administration, I always had the sense that the people in charge of the economy and trade and regulations really knew what they were doing. They were experts before they ever got into government. And with the Biden administration, I get the sense they are experts in hiding how they are really spending money and want to pretend that equals, you know, that just the spending of money somehow equals economic growth. Can you address the expertise or not of the Biden's economic team and your level of faith in them?
Well, I think, you know, there's certainly, you make a good point there. You had, you know, folks like Larry Kudlow, certainly a luminary when it comes to economists as the president's right-hand man when in the Trump administration on the economy. You had people like Brooke Rollins in the White House working on domestic policy and a great leader from the state of Texas, for instance. And you just go down the list of some of the superstars that the Trump administration had from a free market sense. Mm-hmm. Of course, I know the president called on my co-authors, Arthur Laffer and Stephen Moore, and used them as advisors, and people like Steve Forbes. And you had great free market economic minds advising the president. And of course, you know, I think the president as a businessman, President Trump, had a lot of great inclinations on how to make America more competitive again through things like tax reform and others, as we've talked about many times, Mark. And so I don't know that, you know, you have, you're certainly not from a free market sense anyways. You don't have that level of experience in the Biden administration. You have some, you know, very well thought of individuals in the administration. But I think what they're lacking is, you know, probably the common sense free market economic approach, clearly based on the president's proposals in President Biden's administration and kind of looking side by side of what President Trump was able to accomplish. And of course, the results, it's very interesting to compare that pre-COVID results, obviously historically low unemployment rates with President Trump. You had so many good things. You had jobs coming in from Mexico to Michigan being insourced to the United States, manufacturing jobs post tax reform and getting the business taxes down in the Trump years. And now, of course, in this environment today where President Biden at every turn has made an attempt to grow government spending, to advocate for tax increases, and to really, unfortunately, make America less competitive internationally.
Yeah. And, you know, what shakes my faith of those in charge is somehow we've lost sight of core economic principles. For example, that inflation is bad, that even inflation as low as 4% is bad. And isn't that odd in itself that now 4% seems low, even though 3% used to be the high? And so we've gone from 4% inflation is bad to nearly 8% is somehow good. That doesn't give me a lot of confidence when math one day is bad, but now the new math, double that, is somehow good. Is that really what they think, or is it just spin? And if it is, does that mean that 70% Latin America style inflation is even better?
Well, you know, unfortunately, I think it has been a lot of spin on the inflation question, because you trace it back to the start of things when some of us were warning about inflation with the spending and the debt levels where they're at with monetary policy where it's at. And of course, we were told, you know, well, it's, we've had historically low inflation. It's not going to happen. You guys are out. you free market economists are kind of all out in left field in this case of, you know, predicting doom. And of course, we weren't looking to say that we wanted anything bad to happen in the United States economy. We just look at history to say, when you have this level of spending, when you have this level of debt, when you have this level of easy money that's gone on the monetary side for so long, this is a predictable response. And then, of course, when we started to see inflation and things like lumber and commodities that we've talked about, of course, the gas pump and others, and then they said, well, you know, then it's transitory. And of course, that was the next response. And then, of course, when we get to the higher levels and extended levels, we know it's not transitory. We know this is a bigger problem. Then you get the response of, well, it's not that bad, right? Because wages are going up. Right. And my good friend Andy Puzder, who is an advisor to President Trump, he's pointed out time and time again how, yes, wages may be up, nominal, but real wages, after adjusted for this horrible inflation, are actually down from the start of the Biden administration to today. So people's real buying power, even though on paper you may see wages up, your buying power is down because of this dramatic effect of an inflation tax on all of us.
Well, in addition to that, they are making no bones anymore about completely bailing out the stock market. It used to be sort of a dirty secret, and now I see open headlines trumpeting that the Fed swooped in that day and saved the market again from having a negative day. Jonathan, this just comes across as more Ponzi scheme than market forces at work, or God forbid, actual underlying fundamentals of balance sheets and cash flows.
Well, that's an interesting point there, in that, you know, obviously we want to all do well with our 401ks and the pension systems that are already hugely underfunded, as we've talked about many times at the state level. But obviously we want it done holistically and naturally through the market, and not some government cronyism coming to prop things up. And of course, we've seen that under both administrations, on both parties, I should say, in previous years. Obviously, what we want is real economic growth that will have the fundamentals, to your point, that will continue to grow valuations in a holistic way, that are not propped up by some kind of government aid that or some sort of intervention that's something that's going to be short lasting, or be a sugar high to draw people in and then have their savings crushed because it's not sustainable. So obviously we all want the market to do well, but we want it to do well in a holistic sense and long term.
Yeah, I look at this and I can't help but wonder if we're looking at larger shifts in economic forces, certainly from the everyday person. I watch videos of these swing traders and whatnot, and most of them are all about buying the dip and how to identify it, when to get in and when to get out, profiting on just the swings in the price. Not whether a company has a good product or service, it's just what the direction the stock price moves or will likely move. And it seems to me that we as an economy have really lost the sense of value. You could literally put a stock up with a cool name and nothing else and make a fortune on it. Yeah, I mean, is this a problem in the long term, or doesn't it really matter that we're trading digital sheets of paper with no intrinsic value underlying them?
That's a great question. It's definitely something that I think the wise investors are going to be the fundamental investors, right, that look at the underlying, you know, profitability, income streams, and future earnings of a company versus, you know, buying the dips. And you see kind of the day trade, you know, generation now, and kind of the platforms we've talked about. Of course, big government wants to come in and regulate and try to stop a lot of those from happening. But, you know, the Robin Hood type investors today, that it's absolutely a new type of investor that maybe doesn't have the fundamental understanding of a lot of the underlying issues there at play. So it's a big question.
Okay, let's go and take a break there. Come back, we'll be talking about Russia versus the world. Jonathan Williams is the Chief Economist and Executive Vice President for Policy at one of our favorite organizations, the American Legislative Exchange Council. They advise policymakers on how to improve state policies and really get the economies humming again. To find out more about them and what they do, go to alec.org, A-L-E-C.org. And Jonathan, you know, when we originally scheduled this show with you, we weren't anticipating there being an open war now between Ukraine and Russia. And it's been fascinating to watch, you know, setting aside the geopolitics of the matter, we've really crossed into a situation now where it's economic warfare, not just guns and munitions. You can actually take down a country simply by attacking their economy. And here's just a few bullet points in the last few days. China is shunning Russian coal, with banks, Chinese banks, nervous over sanctions. So much for China having Russia's back after they literally just signed that major deal with them. You've got oil at $108 per barrel at a time when Russia could be making a killing in oil. But now BP and Shell just announced they're pulling up stakes in Russia, willing to abandon tens of billions of dollars of equipment there, which is just insane from an economic standpoint for a company. A British gas owner just abandoned Russia as the Nord Stream 2 looks like it's going to be dead in the water. All of its staff was fired. International sanctions against the central Russian banks stopped them from being able to intervene and stop the decline of the ruble. As a result, the Russian ruble collapsed to less than a penny. Adding to that misery, Russian banks have doubled their interest rates to 20%. This is just crazy. It's a new age of warfare where you can just cripple a country without ever firing a shot. What are your thoughts on all of this?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's there's a lot to unpack there, right? And not being an international expert myself, you know, looking at the economics of it, I mean, it has had dramatic effects on Russia in the economy. And unfortunately, who's going to pay the price? It's going to be the people of Russia, mm-hmm. right? And mm-hmm. that you look at the oligarchs and others there who probably keep a lot of their assets in dollar-denominated accounts. If you see a huge devaluation in their currency, which we have and probably will continue to, then it's going to be the middle and lower classes across Russia, the Russian people, that will be harmed by this instead of the rich and powerful. And, you know, this is, you know, it's an interesting, you know, look at what's happened. We never thought that we'd see this kind of, you know, violence there and with Russia going in and attacking Ukraine. We just actually had a good friend of mine who's a member of Congress. I think she's the only Ukrainian born member of Congress who grew up in the old Soviet, controlled Ukraine. And she just came on and talked to ALEC members about her experience and her thoughts on the situation. But obviously, it's horrific. We condemn the violence that's gone on. And it was very interesting to see, you know, the Europeans now really change course in a matter of days from long-held positions of neutrality in many cases, in Germany's case, going from shutting down their domestically produced energy sector in many senses of that, with nuclear reactors being shut down by the Merkel government, and to be overly reliant on Russian oil and gas. And of course, you've got the mistake highlighted once again of the Biden administration greenlighting the Nord Stream 2 pipeline when they were shutting down the Keystone XL pipeline. It is just a predictable mess when it comes to both what the Germans have learned in terms of energy independence and the need for that, and also just some of the mistakes we've made here, but just horrific situation over there. You know, hopefully cooler heads will prevail very soon, and the loss of you know, needless life will cease hopefully as soon as very possible over there. It's just a horrible situation to obviously watch play out.
Sure. And again, I'm trying to steer away from the politics of it. I'm just looking at the economic side of things, because we've essentially got private companies deciding to declare war on Russia. And this is rather disturbing to me that we've got this happening here. We've got these multi-billion, in some cases, trillion-dollar companies with Apple and whatnot. And then you look back at what happened in Canada, where protesters had access to their own money blocked or even confiscated for doing nothing more than try to stand up for freedom. And looking down the road, I just see this as worrisome. Banks have essentially changed their role. They are no longer a neutral repository where you store your money, hopefully safely, but they are now clearly inserting themselves into the transaction process, deciding whether you will be allowed to buy or sell. And money is no longer a neutral means of exchange and standardized value, but on an individual level, your money is only worth what we say it's worth. You know, I'm all for defeating Russia, but not at the expense of surrendering my financial freedom and liberty to do it, because we all know once it's been taken, getting it back is going to be next to impossible.
Well, I think I see those two issues quite differently. But, you know, when you look at, I should say, I think the Canadian issue is one that maybe to unpack here, because, you know, that one to me was very, very clear cut that it's, you know, certainly, I mean, basically, theft happened of those individuals mm-hmm. who donated mm-hmm. to the GoFundMe fund there for the protesters, the truckers there around Ottawa that were protesting the over-the-top, heavy-handed government lockdowns of their economy and their livelihood, and forced vaccinations of those that for the ability to work for a living and to the ability to earn a living, to put meat on the table for their family, would be required to put something in their body against their will. You know, protests against that and then having funds stolen is a direct, I think, huge problem when it comes to public policy making. I do think that, at least personally, I think that's very different what's happening in Russia, just given you've got the massive bloodshed and destruction of a country that was, you know, not provoked. And it's just a horrific situation, of course, what's happening there. The Canadian situation, I do think I've actually talked to several state treasurers and financial officers here in the United States who have said, hey, we need to look at this because companies like GoFundMe should not be allowed to basically steal donations given to this group and give it to, right, I guess, a charity of their choice, whatever right. that's supposed to mean.
Right. Yeah, that was just crazy. Okay, let's take a break a little bit early. Lots more to talk about with Jonathan Williams. He is with ALEC, that's A-L-E-C, American Legislative Exchange Council. We'll put links to their organization and Jonathan's great annual report, Rich States, Poor States, up on iSpyRadio.com. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're talking today to Jonathan Williams. He's the Chief Economist and Executive Vice President for Policy at the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC. That's ALEC.org if you'd like to go visit them. And Jonathan, we were talking in that last segment about the monopoly power that some of these big banks and whatnot have, and now they're unleashing this on everyday customers. And you had mentioned in that last segment, too, that unfortunately this is just going to not hurt so much Russia, but the everyday citizens. And in fact, Apple Pay has announced that they've canceled working with Russian banks. And this is going to, as you say, punish ordinary citizens. Because what it really feels like sometimes is that they are working towards a system where they can instantly cut off millions of people if they don't like your politics. It was interesting because one of the banks that they had just recently canceled with was, I'm sure I'm butchering this, Navicom Bank. And that was one of the banks that was included in sanctions from its Apple Pay-supported banks. And what's odd here is that it's not all Russian banks. Only certain ones have been cut off, and only certain banks are facing sanctions. I mean, if it was truly against Russia, you would think that all banks would be cut off. And we've also got a system where banks and payment systems have essentially stepped into this conflict that isn't even really ours. I mean, we're not at war with Russia. So why are banks and business and payment centers all declaring war on a country with which we are not personally at war?
Well, it's a great question on in terms of why some banks may be affected and others not. I don't know the answer to that. You know, but you get to, I think the broader question is, you know, I think you see, you know, the companies probably horrified with as much as we're all seeing in the international news right now. And it said, you know, we want to do as much as we can. That's a bigger kind of corporate governance question, probably, that I know the C-suites probably had to make those decisions. But it's been certainly one that I think we're seeing companies try to be involved where they can, even as, you know, the American government is clearly not at war with the Russian government at this point, and let's hope it stays that way.
But is this really what we want, where banks are deciding your politics for you, where they are in a position, because they control the streams of money, they can essentially blackmail you by withholding access to your own money unless you agree with their politics?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, you look at it domestically, you know, we've seen some, you know, debate right now in states pop up, and we haven't gotten really involved in this yet. We've had some discussions among some of our members, but some states are saying, well, we're seeing banks, you know, in their words, discriminate against oil and gas companies and not give them access to capital or other items like that. That we actually, Texas has just passed a law in this regard, and other states are considering it this year. So there is, I think, some anger on the right to say, you know, banks are maybe getting involved in politics, even separate from the international question, which I'm not an expert at all on what's going on, why some banks are being sanctioned and some are not, or being, you know, targeted by companies here in the United States. But having a discussion around is, you know, how much politics are being played by banks. And I think that that's still a question a lot of legislators are still resolving in their minds. Mm. And one of the things that we also, you know, are seeing quite a bit is just kind of the around the energy issue is the ESG game that's being played yes. and is being yes. used against many of these publicly traded companies, as you and I have talked about, you know, many times. And so that is something that, you know, certainly I think the Texas legislators had in their minds as they were looking to pass their law. And I think then right now is kind of a free market, you know, community. Is this the right approach to get at that issue, or is some other approach more appropriate? And some that we're looking at right now deals with how do you strengthen up state pension fiduciary rules, getting into a very wonky area. We probably need a whole episode to talk about this, but to ensure that state pension funds and those assets are not being used to play politics and yes. get involved in, let's say, the anti-energy space that many state pension funds are unfortunately getting themselves into these days. Yeah. So how do we protect workers? How do we pre-protect retirees from getting drug into this yeah. This big battle that's at hand over ESG at the state level?
Yeah, and protect our essential long-term freedoms as well. So moving on from Russia, you guys have a great piece there. It was put together by the ALEC team, and it's titled Our Essential Policy Ideas for 2022. And one of the ones that you mentioned is the Great Resignation, also known as the Big Quit. It's an ongoing economic trend in which employees have voluntarily resigned from their jobs en masse, beginning in early 2021, primarily in the U.S. So what's going on with the Great Resignation? Why are people quitting?
Well, I mean, it's a big issue that a lot of people are still trying to figure out if you're from an HR department in a company right now. And how do you keep your employees happy, satisfied? It's obviously a huge, huge issue when you look at millennials and younger workers. They're not going to, you know, take the model of their parents or their grandparents' generation that they're going to stay with one company for 30 or 40 years. And that may be very healthy and very good for those younger workers. But how do you make sure that you balance the needs for those individuals looking to have many experiences over the course of their career? Mm-hmm. And also on the side of the employer, you know, how do you make sure that you incentivize those employees to stay as productive employees, and the employees you really think add value to the organization? How can you keep them more than 2 years? Because if you're going back, obviously, and hiring new individuals for positions that are essential for the success of an organization, that has a huge downward impact on whether it's private sector, whether it's nonprofit sector. And I think we're seeing it even in government, where you're seeing a huge turnover in Congress. You're seeing a huge turnover in the state legislative level. So the Great Resignation phenomenon that's happening across the economy right now is happening in elective office as well.
Well, and you bring up an important point. The problem is that hiring and training and onboarding employees, it's time consuming and it's expensive to get them up to speed and become a contributing member of the organization. So what are some things employers can be doing to stop losing employees at a time when people are more than willing to leave?
Well, and this is kind of down to the basics here. I feel like kind of a Peter Drucker conversation here on management for an organization. But, you know, treat people well, right? Make them well, make them feel good about what they're doing, the value that they provide, compensate them well. You know, guess what? It doesn't take a $15 an hour minimum wage like the president suggested nationally to actually pay people well and pay them in a way that will keep them happy and gainfully employed. And so employers are doing a lot of those things right now. And it's a tough market, though. When you have an opening, it's very difficult to find talent and to keep talent. So it's something that HR departments, like I said, across the country are still trying to figure out the right mix of things. But it kind of comes down to basics. If you want employees to stay with an organization and do well and produce value for you, you treat them well. It doesn't take a government mandate to do that.
You wouldn't think so, but... Okay, let's take a break. We'll have more on the Great Resignation. We'll be doing that with Jonathan Williams after this. And welcome back. We're talking with Jonathan Williams. He's the Chief Economist and Executive Vice President for Policy at one of our favorite organizations, the American Legislative Exchange Council. That's ALEC.org if you want to go visit them. And Jonathan, we were talking in that last segment there about the Great Resignation. And one of the things I probably should have asked you is, are people actually leaving the workforce, or are they just moving to other jobs?
Well, I think in a lot of cases, they're moving to other jobs and always looking for that next kind of rung up the ladder. There is, especially in the last year, there was some great disincentives to stay in the job market, though, when people were making more not working. than they were working in a lot of cases with the supplemental government benefits from the federal level, of course, adding on to what normal state unemployment benefits would look like. And so for months, we were kind of shouting, running, jumping up and down, saying, this is exactly the kind of wrong, perverse government incentives that will hurt the job market long term. And I think there is some still open question as to those who left the job market because of that incentive effect, even though the federal bonuses are not what they were. They're gone relative to what the Biden administration had for a period of time there in the middle of the pandemic. Are these people coming back? And I think that is still somewhat of an open question looking at the data. I think a lot of people have not come back, and that's very concerning, especially when you look at able-bodied working age adults that are not seeking work for whatever reason at this point.
Yeah, and it's kind of an odd phenomenon that's also going on within the larger economy, too. There's a movement called the anti-work movement. And these are mostly younger people that are just basically say they don't want to have to work in order to get money. This ties into the sense of universal basic income, but it's also worrisome as an old person myself now, looking at these younger generation, they just don't seem to see the value in work because work in and of itself has value because you're learning skills, you become a contributing member of the economy, a contributing member of society. It's not just you're existing, but you're actually putting something back into society. And yet somehow this younger generation is missing this.
I think so. And I'm sure you've heard some of his talks over the years or read his books, but Arthur Brooks, who used to run AEI, the American Enterprise Institute here in Washington, and of course is an academic, has written and spoken prolifically around this concept of earned success. And that those individuals that do put in work and actually go out to the workforce, and whether that's running their own business or it's working for an employer, having that stake in success and seeing their efforts bring rewards to themselves and their families in terms of higher standard of living, really the upward mobility that we started this conversation talking about, that the free market economy in the United States, it's unique from so many others across the world, allows this upward mobility through earned success. And that's a virtuous cycle, of course, with the incentive to do better and better and having the ability to keep some of those gains to make your lives better, even more importantly for some, the lives of their children and their grandchildren better than they started as as a employee themselves. So that's, I think, a really important concept. And the anti-work movement and kind of relying on government and kind of having this entitlement mentality that others are going to work and have really at the threat of imprisonment if they don't pay their taxes, with the government coming in and saying, you basically owe these taxes to pay individuals who feel that it's not their civic duty to work. That's a real problem.
Well, similar to the Great Resignation, you've also got this on that page there, the for our essential policy ideas for 2022. It's under zoning and accessory structures, and you say this: as more changes evolve in business, many people may seek better opportunities to work from home. Likewise, much office space in urban areas will lie vacant unless communities recognize the evolving trends and permit more residential units to develop in commercial spaces. And we're certainly seeing that in places like Portland, where there are hundreds of thousands of square foot of formerly occupied busy offices, now just completely vacant, some of them smashed into and looted as well. So this is going to be key for places like Portland. But the problem with Portland is that you've got fewer people want to live there at all because of Antifa and violence. So what kind of solutions would you offer for Portland?
Well, I'm glad that you mentioned that, because the zoning issue is a big one. You look at the need for accessory dwelling for parents or younger family members to cohabitate with other family, and kind of opening up zoning across the board in a lot of cases is an important discussion. In the case of Portland and many of the major cities, in fact, here in Washington, D.C. as well, I think there needs to be a great reset from this discussion that we've seen horrific consequences of violence in big cities when there's been this effort to defund the police. And to see that now, even President Biden acknowledged this in his speech this week. I don't know if that was, we'll see how serious he is about it, because he's got many members of his own side of the ideas here wanting to defund the police still, but it's had such dire consequences in Portland and other major cities, as you know well. It's going to be very difficult for those cities to recover anytime soon.
Yeah, absolutely. Not that the current crop of Oregon legislators is concerned with it, but what kinds of policies should candidates and hopefully newly elected officials put in place to help solve the great resignation problem, or is it more about removing policies?
Well, some of both, I think. In Oregon's case, it's probably going to be removing some of the inhibitors to growing jobs in Oregon versus other states, right? And so in rich states, poor states, which we've talked about, Oregon's economic outlook is 44th, with 50th being worst. And so looking at some of the inhibiting factors for why employers would come and create jobs in Oregon versus 49 other opportunities or even internationally are big, big policy questions. So removing the disincentive to work and save and invest and create jobs in Oregon, such as some of the highest both business and individual tax rates in the country, still having a state level death tax, having some of these major big government inhibitors there, I think is the place to start. And then realizing that, you know, states across the country right now, in my career of watching states, this is the as good as state budgets have had it. And if states can't cut taxes in a year like this, when they've got so much federal money sloshing around in state budgets, not to mention the natural revenue growth, all states have large surpluses at this point, and they continue to grow. So this is a prime opportunity for states, and we're seeing it all across the country, to become much more competitive. We saw Governor Reynolds from Iowa give the response to the president's speech this week. And Governor Reynolds just created a flat tax and has reduced individual and business income taxes dramatically in Iowa. So I expect many more states to follow in that direction. Yep. And I'm always optimistic, Mark, but if Oregon doesn't catch up with these states, they're going to fall behind just by standing still.
Yep, absolutely. Okay, let's go and take a break. We'll wrap things up with Jonathan Williams. We'll ask him about which policies are effective and which are not, and which ones politicians ought to be running on in 2022. And welcome back in our final segment now with Jonathan Williams. He's with ALEC, that's American Legislative Exchange Council. You can go visit them at alec.org. And Jonathan, your whole business is to analyze which policies are effective and which are not, and then advise policymakers and politicians accordingly. So what policies would you advise candidates to run on and to implement once they win?
Boy, it could be a long list there. I'll try to summarize. I think in what's probably most important right now, what we're hearing from legislators and from their constituents, and based on what, you know, good principled policy is, it's certainly addressing, as we talked about, the need to get money out of state government coffers and back into the hands of hardworking men and women and business owners across the country for a couple of reasons. Obviously, to empower them to be successful, enhance their ability to grow and be, and to have a better standard of living in terms of individuals and families. But then secondly is to get the money out of the state capital, because if it's not sent back in terms of tax relief, it's going to be spent, and then it's going to set states up for whenever the federal money does run out. We know it will. Or when the economy turns, let's hope that's a long ways out. I'm afraid it may not be. States will then be set up for massive, quote unquote, need for tax increases. And we've seen this play out time and time again. And it's a predictable disaster to get ahead of and make sure that we're doing the right thing by cutting taxes right now. And then a couple of other things is certainly looking at public safety and yes, making sure that that issue is handled responsibly. We talked about just a minute ago with the cities and, you know, resisting the defund the police movement and to have real rehabilitative justice reforms that we've seen help individuals get back into society that as well. So kind of criminal justice reform and making sure that, you know, we're not defunding the police in these kind of the left-wing cities. And then thirdly here is the issue of the day, at least in Northern Virginia. The reason why we have Governor Glenn Youngkin and not Governor Terry McAuliffe is the issue of education freedom and empowering parents and families and making sure that dollars are not tied to buildings and failed institutions in many cases, but are tied to families and children and are empowering those individuals to make choices that are best for their families. And we're seeing a wave of school choice opportunities move from last year's, I think, historic win on educational savings accounts in West Virginia that was driven by an ALEC board member, Senator Patricia Rucker, an immigrant from Venezuela, who led that effort. And really, West Virginia is a national leader. We're seeing Iowa take it up under Governor Reynolds and many of our members there. And we're seeing states across the country, as parents have looked over the shoulders of their children on their laptops trying to do forced virtual learning from governments with the government lockdowns. They're wondering, why is it that they're being taught some of these things?
Yes.
And of course, you hear these liberal politicians then say, you know, parents, you shouldn't have the ability to decide what's best for your children when it comes to curriculum. And that was the game changer in Virginia, right?
Yep.
So this is a huge issue across the country.
Yeah, that is just absolutely crazy that they would even suggest that. It's almost depressing to hear you talk about all the good news happening in all these other states. But even here in Oregon, there's been some recent polls that show that Oregonians are gloomier on the economy. There was a Portland poll that said that more than 80% of people in Portland are saying that life is getting worse there. You almost can't lose here in Oregon, it would seem, to, if you promise to do the opposite of what Democrats have been doing. But are there some in particular policies that fiscal conservative candidates here in Oregon really ought to zoom in on?
Well, I think so. I mean, and you've got in the region, you have the number one state, let's say in rich states, poor states, Utah, all 14 years at number one. There's a lot of great takeaways there.
Mm-hmm.
But one is, you know, balancing the need for core government services and keeping spending in check, keeping tax rates low, basic good government principles and fiscal conservative principles. But in one of the things they've done that I think is innovative, and I think that any state could benefit from, because we know the property taxes are high in a lot of areas across Oregon. The assessments are going up nationally, but I'm sure in places of Oregon, especially in many cases, something that Utah has done is address property tax burdens, I think very holistically through what they call their truth in taxation process that we have as ALEC, as model legislation. It's something that I think lawmakers across the board should love to see, to say, let's put taxpayers in control. Let's stop this automatic tax increase that happens when assessments go up. Because a lot of cases, local government officials never have to vote on an assessment-driven tax increase. They get to say and pat themselves on the back, we held the line on property taxes, or we cut your property tax rate. And you see your bill went up from the previous year and you wonder, what's this problem? And it's an honesty problem that needs to be fixed. And I think Utah, through their truth in taxation law, has the solution there. And this is one of the biggest things I think fiscal conservatives are tackling right now across the states, is the property tax burden problem.
Yep, and we can certainly use that here in Oregon as well. Jonathan, unfortunately, we're up against the clock. I want to thank you so much for your time today. This has been great.
Always great to join you, my friend.
If you're a candidate or supporting one and you want to beef up your economic policies, look to Utah. Utah has been number one in rich states, poor states economic outlook ranking 14 years in a row. Jonathan has written a terrific article about their success and why they've never lost that top spot. You'll find out the top drivers of a state's economy and what other states can and ought to be doing to improve their own economic outlook. Here in Oregon, there is a lot we can be doing better, although for once, we're not dead last. It just feels that way. We'll put a link to that article up on today's show page. Just head to iSpyRadio.com. That's the letter I, iSpyRadio.com. Read that article and then share that with your favorite candidate. You're informed so you can help them be informed. That's how grassroots work. It's the trickle-up method. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.